Yesterday I proposed that resisting anything is resisting Buddha nature. And Nanette asked, well, is resistance Buddha nature? And I said, yes. Maybe more accurately, we could say resistance is a manifestation of Buddha nature. But just to add to that dialogue this morning, resistance is a manifestation of Buddha nature, but if we don't fully appreciate the Buddha nature of resistance, then that Buddha nature doesn't help us. And then we could ask, well, does non-appreciation have Buddha nature? Yes. But if we don't appreciate the Buddha nature of non-appreciation, the non-appreciation's Buddha nature doesn't help us. Buddha nature pervades the universe. How can we really appreciate it? It's trying to help us to let it help us. We have to appreciate it. I thought of these Sesshin encouragements from Shodo Harada Roshi, living Rinzai Zen teacher. I find just arouses energy and a deepening of diligence when I hear these instructions. He says, Sesshin means to directly encounter one's mind, to touch one's mind. The word also expresses gathering together of mind. This is not something we can do in our day-to-day lives. During Sesshin, we must separate ourselves from all our daily routine. We must touch directly, encounter directly that very place from which the mind comes forth, which we could call Buddha nature, from which the mind comes forth. Mind is a manifestation of Buddha nature. Therefore, when we do Sesshin, we must leave behind all connections to our daily and social life, or it's not Sesshin. During Sesshin, each of the 7 days has its own meaning. The first day is for starting off. The second is for putting forth our full energy. By the third day, we're getting used to it all. But throughout the first 4 days, we have a hard time with our bodies. Have you noticed? By the fifth day, we're a little tired, but we become accustomed to our legs hurting. These are universal Sesshin descriptions, right? Today is the fifth day, by the way, in case you lost track. By the fifth day we're a little tired, but we've become accustomed to our legs hurting. Remember though, at this point, it's not about having only two more days to go, but that this day comes only once. This is especially on the fifth day. We must understand this. On the sixth day, seeing the end, we finally put forth everything we have. The seventh day is the last stretch. We cannot do our practice vaguely or haphazardly. To do so would be a waste of sesshin days. Our life's being shaved off by the second. We must understand how to use sesshin in the best possible way. Putting everything aside, facing straightforward, we work inventively and creatively to encounter the true source of mind. During sesshin time, everything in one's life is put aside in order to clarify this great matter, the most important issue, the problem of life and death. This is not about how to make today's living or how to solve emotional problems. If we can just once cut through to the deep root of life, Buddha nature, then life becomes centered and clear. No matter what ideas or life plans we may have held to this time, they all dissolve at this moment. We must realize that ultimate place, that very essence, nature of our existence. We have to directly encounter that which actually lives through us. For this, all of our life within society must be cut off, separated from totally, only facing in the inner direction of our true mind, our true nature, we continually cut subtly and refine. Virya paramita, diligent deepening with energetic enthusiasm. It's hard to put everything aside. We're right in the middle of town, right in the middle of our life. And this is not neglecting our bodhisattva vow to be right in the middle of our life with all beings. We don't cut off any beings. And at the same time, at the time of sesshin, temporarily let go of everything else. It's all set up just to help us, support us to be really here. So just at the end of the breakfast break, I was looking at those words about separating from society and cutting off all social involvements, and the phone rang. Should I answer it? It's a sheen. Well, it's right there next to my hand. The Han's about to sound for Zazen. Well, just to answer, maybe it's somebody calling to cancel or add a day of sesshin. And a voice from far away, from the foothills of the Himalayas, in a distant time zone late at night, comes to the phone, and it's Shoho. And I think to myself, oh, this would be nice to chat for a few hours or so. We haven't talked for a while. She's like, I know it's sesshin, and I know your schedule, and I've calculated The han's probably about the sound. Yes, it's about the sound. Good to hear your voice, but it's time for zazen. I just have... can I just ask one question quickly before you go? She said. Okay, yeah, of course. He said, why is it that permanent mind can't know impermanent mind?
Got a minute.
And I thought, ah! Is this a test? She's taking her final exams and writing essays at the end of her school semester in Kathmandu. And this was apparently some... she had to write some essay about this. What's that? Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's okay to... you know, it's hard enough questions. You could probably look in any books you want and still have a hard time. I thought, ooh, that is hard. But I thought, this is actually kind of what we're talking about these days. At least in the Indian tradition, Buddha nature is said to have the quality of permanence. The sixth ancestor and Dogen both say impermanence is Buddha nature. Maybe contradicting or startling the Parinirvana Sutra. And as we talked about in the past, we could say the whole totality of impermanence, all the arising and ceasing conditions of the universe that we call impermanence, that totality never changes in the slightest. The totality of impermanence is permanently shining. And I think that's what this question was coming from, is like the classical presentation of the mind we call Buddha nature, the permanent nature of mind, the unchanging nature of mind, the unborn, undying nature of mind, cannot know the impermanent, rising and ceasing, ordinary dualistic mind. But I think that was the proposal, is that it can't know it. But why can't it know it? That's the question. Any guesses? Yeah, I would. And I think I would take here to mean like to be able to actually like meet it and relate to it, meet and relate to the impermanent mind, know it in the way that we know like the impermanent book, and the impermanent mind can be aware of and know impermanent thoughts. We can think, I'm thinking of an elephant. Now it's gone. Like we can know, the impermanent mind can know the other aspects of the impermanent mind. But I would understand that in that kind of knowing, that the Buddha nature doesn't actually know our conceptual mind in that way, and vice versa. Same for the same reason, I would say, is that our conceptual dualistic mind doesn't know this unborn, undying Buddha nature.
So, with the
So I think of the Buddha himself as kind of impermanent mind, as he's before he's fully Buddha. And then so becoming fully permanent, you know, of that permanent all-pervading mind. So that makes me think, could he know impermanent mind?
Could he remember before he was the Buddha?
But it's not what we remember, right? So it's kind of like, is it a kind of once you make that shift, that it's just the two are like on parallel universes?
Yeah, I think that would be one way to look at it. Which we could call the two truths are like parallel universes. The ultimate truth and the conventional truth are not separate, really, but and one implies the other, and yet they never actually meet. We were talking yesterday about how we don't actually, the two truths aren't really merged together. Because in some ways they're like parallel universes. Yes.
What comes to mind is not knowing is most intimate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're just practicing intimacy with the other, then to practice intimacy would be not knowing.
Yeah. Not knowing in the usual, in the way that we're talking about knowing here, is most intimate, yes.
Also not grasping.
Almost same thing.
Yeah.
Knowing is a subtle form of grasping. Knowing an object apart from mind. We think that's not so graspy, is it? Well, yeah, that's kind of like you could even say it's like the basic grasping from which all other grasping comes, is knowing objects as separate from mind. Yeah, there is... Jane says, well, it depends what we mean by knowing. I think there is a kind of knowing that's like a Buddha knowing. Particularly, I think of Tian Tong Hongzhir in his poem about the point of Zazen. That mind of Zazen, describing Buddha nature mind, he says, it's knowing without touching things, facing without encountering objects, he describes. So like knowing without the mind touching a thing, without the mind meeting, touching, meeting, knowing something other than itself. But there can be this knowing without touching things other than the mind. Or meeting things without encountering objects. Unusual. But that's his poem celebrating Zazen mind. So she wanted a kind of, a valid philosophical proof for this statement. So I said something like, well, if we can assume that permanent means independent, they usually go together. I have to stop, maybe have to put a little time into thinking about how does permanence necessarily imply independence? Do they always go together? But it seems like mostly if something's permanent and unchanging, it means it's independent. We were talking yesterday too about independence and dependence. How is it that, what's the principle of when samadhi and prajna are practiced equally, Buddha nature is clearly seen? And Huangbo said, when one doesn't depend on anything throughout the 24 hours, the principle is fully known, expressed. So being independent in this sense of again, two senses of independence as like the delusion that things, that phenomena independently exist in and of themselves is the illusion. But when we're talking about independent mind of Buddha nature, independent nature of mind, we could say it's that unconditioned, unborn nature of mind that actually doesn't depend on anything. Again, that is the totality of all dependent arisings, but that totality itself shines alone. So if permanent mind was independent, then I said, then it can't know impermanent mind, because to know or relate to another mind, that makes it then dependent, interdependent with that mind. In the realm of independence, there's no relationship at all. It's one. You could call it the realm of oneness. The realm of oneness, there's no relationship. Right? As soon as you have two or more, then there's relationship. In oneness, it is complete intimacy. All relationships are contained within that. But that oneness can't relate to anything because it includes everything. There's nothing outside of oneness. Right? Oneness can't have like a oneness relating to like another oneness, because then that's two. Oneness is unrelated to anything. Therefore, permanent mind can't know an impermanent mind, or an independent mind couldn't know an interdependent mind. And then the Han went and I had to come to Zazen. Yes. Really just a flash.
Yeah, flash. Most of us tend to have a little flash at some time of impermanent. And so to say that permanent mind is like independent seems kind of, you know, an everyday reality, like true 99.9% of the time. But then, you know, this thing that we say, Lord, you are already such a person. So, how does that square, do you think, with kind of the logic of that these two things cannot be understood one to the other?
Yeah, like how would we ever then know Buddha nature,
how you mean? Even come to Zazen?
If I think what we're talking about is like that the way of being that you could say is always, it's always the case, right? The two truths are always the case, like right now. But you could say, is it possible to even recognize, even for a flash, for a moment, to recognize with our impermanent mind such a unchanging nature of mind, Buddha nature. Is that kind of what you're asking? Even for just 1 second, wouldn't it violate this principle that an impermanent mind couldn't know a permanent mind? And I think that, yeah, that's true. So, I think I would say that at the time of everything dropping off, when there's no time and space and, no thinking at all, and the conceptual mind is not operating, just being the nature of mind, we don't know it, and then that, you could say that doesn't exactly end, because that's always the case. It's more like the impermanent mind has temporarily dropped off, And then the impermanent mind temporarily arises again, usually quite quickly. and then it can has a kind of memory. It has a memory, you could say, of something like that was really immersed zazen or something. We can kind of like comment on it, but we're like not, you know, it's not exactly meeting that mind still, right? It's meeting like a memory of it. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Postcard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's the best you can get.
Postcard.
Yeah, postcard.
Wish you were from the... Yeah. I wish you were here. Or Suzuki Roshi's got the talk on letters from emptiness. But a deeply felt sense.
Deep, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, we could even maybe say an intuition is kind of like the heart. That, it is so. And we're, maybe in Sishin, we're swimming around that territory, you know, more than usual. Like we're, that intuition of the heart is more open than usual because there's less distraction than usual. So you could say, so that's how, like, our, why do we practice Buddha nature is somehow, like, keeps pulling us back. It's very mysterious because it's kind of hard to talk about. Because it's not so much like, okay, here's this, you see this like that, and then it's like that, and that's why you do this. It's more like, here we are, sitting again, with the painful butt and knees once more. Huh? And then I'm like, oh yeah. And huh? Oh yeah. Back and forth. So we've reached the point in Dogen's Busho of the most famous Zen story about Buddha nature ever. You know what that one is? The dog! The dog has arrived! We've reached the dog day! Is your dog outside?
She is.
Be careful with your sounds.
Maybe this is from mom.
When we really start exploring, we can maybe bring her in to do a little dissection to look for the Buddha nature. So there's maybe little known story that before Jiaozhou said no and yes about a dog's Buddha nature, there was another story about a dog's Buddha nature. I was surprised about this. I heard from Shohaku Okamura, then I found it in some other commentary. It's not in the major koan collections, but it's in the huge transmission of lamp records. This is a Zen practitioner, Kozen Ikan in Japanese. And he was a Dharma heir of Matsu, amongst like 80 others or something. And Jiaozhou, who is most known for this Buddha nature of the dog story, is a disciple of Nanchuan, who is a disciple of Matsu. So this first story is kind of like Zhaozhou's Dharma uncle. It's like it's the previous generation. So it's before Zhaozhou. So we think, that was the first time anybody ever asked that the Zhaozhou. Maybe it was like all over China at this point. Everyone's asking about dogs, Buddha nature. This is the first recorded story asking about a dog's Buddha nature. And apparently the Kozen Ikan, when he was a teenager, saw an animal being killed by, a hunter or a butcher or something. And that was what prompted him to leave home and become a monk. He's like, I don't understand. What is this life and death? And why do we cause so much suffering? So at least Shohaku Okamura said something like, we can maybe deduce that he really loved animals. And maybe that's significant to this story. A monk asked Ikan, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And I think in the Chinese it's even something like, does this dog have Buddha nature? So they were probably talking about a particular dog, and maybe the dog lived in Zhaozhou's temple too. Maybe just there were always dogs around Zen temples, and that's why they're always asking about dogs, Buddha nature. Does this dog have Buddha nature or not? And remember that this word have is u in Japanese, which means can mean have or is or existence. And mu is the opposite, which can mean doesn't have or isn't any or no or non-existence. All of that's in there. So it's the sentence is kind of like, and the same question to Zhaozhou later too. Does this dog oo Buddha nature or moo Buddha nature? Does it have it or not have it? So we translate, does this dog have Buddha nature or not? But oo and moo are both in the question actually. Does it oo Buddha nature or moo? So maybe Dogen would even translate the question as, is the dog Buddha nature or isn't it? You could translate it that way too. But generally it's, thought to be, does it have Buddha nature or not? And Ikan said, yes, or ooh, or it exists. Does the dog have Buddha nature or not? Yes. The monk said, Master, do you have Buddha nature? And Ikan said, no. Moo. The dog has Buddha nature, but I don't. Then the monk says, but all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why do only you not have it? And Ikan says, I am not part of all sentient beings. And the monk says, well then if you're not a sentient being, are you a Buddha? Those two are often, there's Buddhas and sentient beings. And usually thought to be, there's no other choice if we're talking about something with eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind.
Robots.
That's true. Or mannequins. But they usually don't speak. Robots maybe could speak. And he said, I'm a robot. Oh no, he didn't. I'm not part of all sentient beings. If you're not a sentient being, are you a Buddha? Ikan said, this is not a Buddha. He didn't actually say, I am not a Buddha, but he said, this. And Okamura Roshi, he says, he thought that's significant that he says, this, meaning like this collection of five skandhas, or this body and mind. Because you should say, if we say, I am not a Buddha, then, or a sentient being, that's maybe a simpler dialogue. It'd still be a nice Zen dialogue, because it's true that I, who I think I am, actually am not a sentient being or a Buddha. I am just pure delusion, the I that I think I am. But he says, even this, this body and mind experience, is not a Buddha. The monk said, ultimately, what thing is this? This is not a Buddha. The monk says, ultimately, what thing is this? Ikan said, this is not a thing. It's not a Buddha, it's not a sentient being, and it's not a thing. The monk says, can we see it and think of it? Ikan says, even though we think of it and try to know it, we cannot reach it. Even though we discuss it, we cannot grasp it. Therefore, it is said, incomprehensible, wondrous, and unspeakable. That's the first story about Buddha nature. Oh yeah, what about the dog? Yeah, so he, you know, Ikan, doesn't have Buddha nature, is not a Buddha sentient being, and is not a thing, but he said the dog does have Buddha nature. And they didn't go further about that dialogue, actually, right? So we could say, well, why didn't he say the dog is also not a Buddha nature, not a thing? Maybe we could say that Ikan was a greatly realized one who actually like really appreciated the that truth, that he's not a Buddha, a sentient being, or a thing, totally ungraspable, and that dog probably doesn't fully appreciate that. Maybe that's one interpretation.
Or maybe the conversation just moved on.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, because we have these stories.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been... Maybe we wouldn't ask the question if he said, does a dog have Buddha nature? And he said, no. And then he said, do you have Buddha nature? No. Well, why not? But he's making a distinction. The dog does and I don't. So that, you know, that almost like he has gone beyond Buddha, you could say. And the dog, not. And, you know, in these later stories too, there is some, you know, I think they're choosing a dog over a person for particular reasons that we can get into as we get into it. Yeah.
Does the Chinese have the same, you know, if Chinese has the same equivocation as Japanese with has or is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, if you look at this word with respect to the dog, it says yes, the dog is Buddha nature. It's an expression of what is. And if you read it as do I have, the answer is no.
Yeah, but since they're using the same words, but you could say something like that.
It's important, the difference between having.
Mm. You could also say it's like, if we want to not say that he's promoting his realization over the dogs, which, you know, might be okay for to say that there's humans have more fully appreciate their Buddha nature than dogs, because dogs don't have the issue. They're not thinking about their Buddha nature. But we could also say that the dog has the he could be praising that the dog actually has his Buddha nature, and I, kind of like Bodhidharma saying, don't know. It could be in a really humble way of like, that all beings have Buddha nature, including this dog, and it's going to become a Buddha, but as for me, I have no idea what's going on here. I can't say anything. When I get here, I don't know anything at all. Could be like that. So then we have in the record of Jiaozhou some other related stories, like a monk asked Jiaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Jiaozhou says, the door of every house leads to the capital. And the capital at that time was Chang'an, capital of China, which means eternal peace. So you could say, you could translate it as the door of every house leads to eternal peace. Kind of nice. End of story. The doorways of all our houses open to the one capital in the center of the country, eternal peace. Poetic way of saying it doesn't matter what kind of doorway, a poor house, a rich house, a dog house, a cat house, a human house, all their doors lead to the capital. Like all roads lead to Rome. The door opens, and of course, then the path from the door to the capital, straight shot from every door. So, also in Jiaozhou's temple, there were at least one cypress tree around. You might have heard. Was had a wonderful opportunity to practice at Jiaozhou's temple, also, and where there's an active practice. If anyone ever wants to practice Zen in China, that's maybe could be the one of the best places to go. They have a whole kind of like international practice center developing, where they have lots of sesshins and so on. At that time, it wasn't quite that way, so it was unusual for a few of us Americans to be there. But it's now called, the name of the temple, I don't think it was called this in Jiaozhou's time, but now it's called Cypress Grove Temple. And there are actually cypress trees like all over the grounds, which, you know, did they plant them because of these ancient stories about Jiaozhou and the cypress tree? Like, I'm gonna guess, why did Bodhidharma come from the west and Jiaozhou said the cypress tree in the garden? Or did they plant them there? Or were they there in Jiaozhou's time and these are descendants of those cypress trees? So one time a monk asked Jiaozhou, does the cypress tree have Buddha nature or not? It's kind of like, we got the word about the dog. Does the cypress tree have Buddha nature or not? Jiaozhou says, yes. Ooh. Monk said, well then, when will it become a Buddha? If it has Buddha nature. Jiaozhou said, when the sky falls to the ground. I would assume here that the character for sky, usual character for sky in Chinese, actually is the character used to translate shunyata, or emptiness. So it could say when emptiness meets the ground. when emptiness meets form, when the sky falls to the ground. Does the oak tree have Buddha nature or not? Yes. When will it become Buddha? When the sky falls to the ground. Monk says, when will the sky fall to the ground? Jiaozhou says, when the cypress tree becomes Buddha. Dependent co-arising, just playing itself out. No one is in control of this inconceivable totality. And one time a monk asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? And one version of the story is Jiaozhou says, no. Moo. Or mrrr. End of story. And that's the version in the Mumon Khan, in the No Gate Barrier collection of koans, as Ashuso Neti recited the Mumon's commentary on that case about when you're working on this no of Jiaozhou's, it's like swallowing a red hot iron ball and so on. So that's in that particular, say, in the Mumon Khan collection, it's like it's very direct and practice oriented. It's just giving you these short, sweet koans to chew on and practice with, and then like the Book of Serenity and the Blue Cliff Record, the other two main koan collections, are maybe more literary. They're longer versions sometimes of stories. The commentaries are much longer. You can work on them more leisurely. I think Tenshin Roshi says, even comparing the Book of Serenity to the Blue Cliff Record, Blue Cliff Record already has more extensive commentary and brings up a lot of other stories compared to the Mumon Khan. But he said the Book of Serenity, some people call it more literary than even the Blue Cliff Record. But he said something like, I would call it just more grandmotherly. Instead of more literary, it's more grandmotherly. Like, it just gives you a lot more to work with. Maybe a lot more to confuse you. A lot more, but very poetic and beautiful, expression, the Book of Serenity. So this koan, I don't think, doesn't appear in the Blue Cliff Record, but it does in the Book of Serenity in the extended version, which is case number 18. It's case number 1 in the Mumon Khan. This is like often the first koan in Rinzai Zen that people are given to chew on. The Book of Serenity, case 18 version, is a monk comes and says, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Jiaozhou says, yes. And the Tian Tung, the collector of the koans, adds little verses to each line by line verse. So Tian Tung's little verse is to yes, to the line yes, he says, yet it's never been added. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Jiaozhou says, yes. Tian Tung in parentheses writes, yet it's never been added. This yes that it has, this ooh of Buddha nature, hasn't been added. The monk goes on to say, well, since it has Buddha nature, why is it then in this skin bag of a dog? And Jiaozhou says, he knows, yet deliberately transgresses. And then later another monk comes to Jiaozhou and says, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Jiaozhou says, no, this time. Last time he said yes, now he says no, mu. And Tianton's comment is, yet it's never been removed. There's a lot more comments, but I appreciate those two. To the answer, yes, but it's never been added. No, but it's never been removed. The monk says, well, but all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why doesn't a dog have it? And Jiaozhou says, he still has karmic consciousness. So now Dogen's going to extensively get into commenting on these, on this story. But to note that in the Book of Serenity, first Jiaozhou says yes, and then we have that little explanation. And then part two is he says no, and there's some, I think in the Book of Serenity commentary, it's something like, there's a story about giving a jewel and then pointing out a flaw in the jewel and taking it back. So first you give Buddha nature. First, yes, all beings have Buddha nature. But then you, wait, there's a little flaw in this. You take it back. You say no. So it's first giving and then taking it back. Ooh, and then moo. Whereas in Dogen, Dogen's going to tell the same story here, these two parts, and with the same two answers. But he reverses it. And at least Okamura Roshi says, he thinks that's very significant. It's not just random, he thinks, because whereas first giving everything and then taking it away is kind of like the Buddha nature, but then we take it all away. We emphasize emptiness. We emphasize mu. We emphasize can't find anything at all. Whereas Dogen first says no, and then concludes with yes, because Dogen's more into the full manifestation of Buddha nature. Maybe Dogen slightly leans towards the u side as the final word, whereas the Book of Serenity slightly leans towards emptiness, no unfindability as the final word. At least that's Shohaku's theory. Yeah.
I just think it's terribly important to distinguish between have and be.
Yeah, well, that's what Dogen spent the first part of his essay doing.
I can see how Buddha nature has the dog, but the dog is Buddha nature. Anything that exists just can't really have. It's just an attribution. It's just an indication. It's just a construction. It can't have because it has no substantial being. So it can't have, but it can be. So Buddha nature expresses itself in a lot of special cases, one of which is a dog. So it has a dog. But a dog can only be Buddha nature. Like we can only be Buddha nature in the sense that we are all on a trajectory to Buddhahood.
Oh, so I think it's this difference between the have and the be,
yeah,
for those who weren't in the beginning of our Shobogenzo Busho class, that was Dogen's main point. And maybe people often, when they talk about this essay of Dogen's, that's the main point they refer to when Dogen quotes the sutra saying all sentient beings without exception have Buddha nature. Shitsu-u Busho, without exception have. Dogen turns it and says all sentient beings in their entirety, or all sentient beings entirety of being. He shitsu-u is complete being. The complete totality of all being is Buddha nature. So maybe that's the main point. And Dogen begins his whole essay that way to make sure we remember that. And so we always have that context. So,
which would follow up. I'm having an echo in my mind of the line of the Jhumir Samadhi where it says, you are not it, in truth it is you. Is this a kind of a harmony with Mu and the dog?
How so?
In the sense that the image we see in the mirror, we can say has existence. We are not the image in the mirror. The image in the mirror is us. You are not it. The fact it is you.
Oh, we could say, you are not Buddha nature. Buddha nature is you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If we were to use the word have, which is problematic for the reasons you mentioned, I think we really can't say that beings have Buddha nature, but we might be able to get away with saying that Buddha nature has sentient beings, in the sense that Buddha nature manifests as Buddha, as sentient beings. Yeah, you are not it. It actually is you. I'll just read the first comment of Dogen. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, Chen Chu, Dasher, does that dog have Buddha nature or not? I think all the comments could still play out if we say, is that dog Buddha nature or not? But Dogen, in this case, seems to approach it, at least the translators are going back to the have part here because that's the usual way people read it. So he's kind of maybe just commenting from that perspective, even though if we asked him, he'd say, well, of course, we mean is. The meaning of this question must be clarified. It asks neither whether a dog has Buddha nature or whether it does not have Buddha nature. It doesn't ask that. The question, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? It doesn't ask whether a dog has Buddha nature or not. It asks, does a person of iron still practice the way? That's what it asks. And man of iron, person of iron is a Zen term for someone who's continually practicing, never stops practicing. We could hear it like, we could hear it as, someone continually practicing still practice the way? Or does Buddha nature still need to practice? Either talking about the dog, or the Buddha nature manifesting as a dog, or maybe even as Zhao Zhou. Does Zhao Zhou still, great Zhao Zhou, still have to practice? And Dogen goes on to say, Zhao Zhou blundered into a poison hand, and his resentment may be intense, but it's a means of seeing half a real saint at last after 30 years. Which is a quote from another Zen story of somebody looking for this student for a long time and finding and saying, oh, I've finally seen half a real saint at last after 30 years. So he's saying, Zhao Zhou plundered into this poison hand of the monk who asked the question. Kind of like, oh, poor Zhao Zhou. This monk asked, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou blundered into the poison hand of this monk and his question, and his resentment may be intense, like, I should never have put myself in a room where you would ask me that question. But it is a means of seeing half a real saint at last after 30 years. Like, in other words, this is the greatest question anyone could ever ask, and Zhao Zhou's going to have a really hard time with this question. It's kind of saying that. And this thing about an iron person practicing the way. I just thought of that, this story that I can't remember where it is. So maybe, does anyone know the story about Kishizawa Ion and Iron Person lives here? Well, this is my memory of it, because maybe it's not written anywhere. And it's just, maybe it's oral lore. It's probably written somewhere. But it's a story about our lineage, which is kind of nice. That Suzuki Roshi, you know, he received Dharma from Gyokujin So-on, Daiyosho. But he also practiced extensively with Kishizawa Ion, who was a Shobogenzo teacher. Actually really great teachers of that time. And happened to live in the same town as Suzuki Roshi when he was young, at near Rinso Inn. And Kishizawa Ion's teacher was Nishiari Bokusan, who was one of the like really great revivers of Soto Zen. Apparently fierce character. We have his commentary on the Genjo Koan. So, particularly a Shobogenzo scholar. So this is a story about Kishizawa Ion, Suzuki Roshi, one of Suzuki Roshi's most important teachers, and his teacher. So, Dharma transmission documents involve, amongst many things, this phrase, iron person lives here. It's a nice phrase for Sashin. The iron person that can't be shaken by the eight winds. I could say this is part of what's transmitted, is iron person lives here. And so apparently Kishizawa Ion, as a young Zen student, knew about that somehow. And he really wanted his teacher, Nishiari Bokusan, who was a great calligrapher, to write that calligraphy for him. But he wanted him to write, iron person lives here, to hang on his wall or something. But he knew that, like, I can't ask him to write that. It's too much. But I really want his calligraphy of that. So he knew that there was this old man who lived in the village who was kind of like a drinking buddy of Nishiari Bokusan. I think he wasn't even a practitioner. Maybe a practitioner of some kind, but I think they were just like old friends, two old men in the village that like to drink sake together sometimes. And so he said, young Ion said to this drinking buddy, like, can I ask you to ask Roshi for some calligraphy next time you're having a drink? And he's really relaxed. So sure. And he said, can you ask him to write, don't say what it's for, just say it's for you. Say you would like him to write iron person lives here. He said, sure. So then one time they were drinking some sake, they were really relaxed, having a good time, and maybe Bokusan was even taking out his brush and ink and his
to scribble on bar napkins.
Yeah, maybe. and his buddy said, oh, could you do some calligraphy for me? I really appreciate your calligraphy, Bokusan. Oh, sure. Anything particular you'd like me to write? He said, how about, iron person lives here. And suddenly, Nishiari Bokusan got very serious. he like snapped out of his relaxed mode. And he's like, who told you to ask for that calligraphy? And he said, I just thought I... No, who told you? Well, it was your student, Kisawa Ion. And at that point, his expression changed again from this kind of fierce expression to he relaxed again, and tears came to his eyes. That's the story. And then many years later, Bokusan transmitted Dharma to the now older Kisawa Ion. So when this monk asked, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Dobin says, that question does not mean, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? It means, does an iron person practice the way? May all beings, even dogs and cats, fully appreciate their Buddha nature. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.